Archiving started.
Okay, well, welcome everyone to our special Polar Connect event. We have excited that Anne-Marie, now I can't remember how to say your last name, Pasqualoni, is at McMurdo Space in Antarctica, and she's joining us today for a special Polar Connect event that's for the students in our sea ice class and other educators that are interested in learning about marine sciences in Antarctica. It's November 9th, and this event is being archived so that we can use it later on. A few things before we get into the presentation. We wanted to go over the Horizon WIMBA platform. I know several of our participants today are new to this platform, and so the next slide shows some of the features of using Horizon WIMBA. The slide should be changing in the center of the screen for you, and unlike mine where it wasn't changing, and so you'll see the content there. If you have questions at the end, you're welcome to use a voice over IP or talk on the phone. When we ask you to do so, or you have a question, press the talk button and hold it down the entire time you're talking and then let go. You can, of course, talk and chat to everyone in the chat feature, which is down in the bottom left. And you can also see the list of participants growing, which is good, on the bottom right. If you have a question that you want to ask or along the way and you don't want to interrupt, you can click the little hand icon below the list of participants, and that lets us know you have a question. And if you have any trouble as you go along, you can type a text to Sarah, who's actually listed as Allison York online, or myself, Janet, or try going out into the exit or lobby rooms. So with that, I will just let Anne-Marie know that there is nobody, Anne-Marie can't see the slides yet. Things are loading up for her, so she's going to be following us along at PDF, so we will relay chats to her as they come up. So the next slide is our roll call slide, and we'd like you all to introduce yourselves, where you come from, and your interest in participating in this presentation. And we'll start with the top of the list. If you're using Voice over IP, click on the talk button, hold it down the entire time you're talking. So we'll start with Allison.
Hello, I am Allison, and I teach 7th and 9th grade science at Ashley Hall, which is an all-girls school, independent school here in Charleston, South Carolina. And myself and actually Megan Ward, who's also on this list, decided to take this course together so that we can integrate a lot of this information into what we're teaching.
Okay, great. Welcome, Allison. We know we have Mary McFarland online, and she's going to type in where she comes from and everything, and we'll relay that, but she doesn't have a mic, so we'll go on to Megan. Go ahead, Megan.
Hi there, I'm Megan Ward, and I teach with Allison at Ashley Hall School in Charleston, South Carolina. And I teach 9th grade biology, AP biology, and marine science, and I'm excited about integrating what I learned into the curriculum. This will be new stuff to me and to the girls, so we're very excited. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right, and I'm going to relay Mary's text to Anne-Marie in particular. So she says her name is Mary, that's in parentheses, Emmy McFarland. She works at the Pink Palace Museum in Memphis, Tennessee. She's an exhibit material and she's working on exhibit material and programming about Antarctica here at the museum. It is wonderful to meet you all, and I'm so glad to be here. And we should say that Mary works with one of our Polar Trek teachers, Alex Eilers, who's going, Anne-Marie, she's going to be joining the Wendell Seal.
Oh, wow.
At Jennifer Burns' group in January.
Wonderful. Oh, wow.
Yeah, very exciting for her. So, okay, I think Bruce, we had another student join here, Bruce, but he's probably still getting squared away. I don't see any connection. So we'll go on to Phyllis. If Phyllis, can you try pressing the talk button and seeing if you can talk to us?
Well, I'm on the phone. Can you
hear me? Oh, there you are.
And Bruce is on the phone.
Okay, great. Yes, go ahead.
Still downloading components on the computer, so.
All right, why don't you introduce yourself, Phyllis?
I work at the Seward and Marine Center for the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I'm just an informal educator, just interested in your topic.
Okay, great. And we'll go back up to Bruce. Go ahead, Bruce. Maybe Bruce hasn't joined us by phone yet. Okay, we're going to go to Uta.
So, hello, everybody. I'm Ute Kedan, and I work at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I was a former polar track educator as well, traveling on the icebreaker Odin and the USC Chihili, to both polar regions, so the North Pole and the Antarctica region. And I'm very pleased having you all in class. And so welcome to the course, and hopefully you find the material useful for your students and for your education.
Okay, and one more person that just joined us that should introduce herself since she'll be talking next week is Sarah. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hello?
Yep, we hear you.
Oh, okay. Hi, I'm here. I'm Sarah Hardy from University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Great. Thanks for joining. And Sarah's just checking this out today because she's going to be presenting on Monday for this very same class. All right. We'll get to Bruce in a little bit. I think that unless he can hear me now, he should introduce himself via the chat room. So we're going to move on. You've heard a lot about Polar Trek through the website as well as us just chatting here this morning. Some of you might not be very familiar with it, so this is just a slide about what is Polar Trek. Polar Trek is the program that is funding this online course, and we're working in conjunction with UAF. But overall, Polar Trek is a program where we match teachers with researchers to go to the polar regions and learn more about what is happening there and bring it back into their classrooms. And this sea ice cyber-based class that we've started with UAF is kind of a side piece to our overall program, another way to integrate and involve people that might not get to go to the polar regions. With that, I think we'll just turn it over to Anne-Marie and have her start presenting. So we're going to be on your first slide, and just cue us when you need to change slides.
Great. Okay. So you can skip down to the next slide. We're studying adaptations of marine worms in Antarctica. We have a research team of five people that started off with us. Now it's just me and McMurdo, but it did start off with a pretty big group. We have Dr. Adam Marsh, who's my advisor at the University of Delaware, Dr. Stacy Kim, who is over at Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz. We have Mike League, who was our Polar Trek teacher, and me and Stephanie Guida, our graduate students in Adam Marsh's lab. So we had a pretty big team to start off with. If you go to the next slide, we met each other all in New Zealand since four of us are originating from Delaware and Stacy Kim is from California. We all met up in New Zealand at the U.S. Antarctic Center. We got all of our issued gear, all of our issued belongings, and then we boarded a C-17 American Air Force jet. And if you go to the next slide, you can kind of see how we were all packed in there. This was on August 15th, so what would have been in Delaware, our summer, we were going into the Southern Hemisphere's wintertime. We had about a six-hour plane ride kind of squished together on the C-17. And then if you go to the next slide, you can see two pictures of the continent of Antarctica. So we were headed to McMurdo Station, which is kind of at the bottom, if you see. It's in McMurdo Sound at the southern tip of Ross Island. This is the largest Antarctic, U.S. Antarctic Research Station, but there are also two more. So we have the Geographical South Pole Station, which is labeled, and we also have a station called Palmer Station, which is in the Antarctic Peninsula. But we were based in McMurdo Station, as are most scientists. So then if you head to the next slide, I was leaving my friends at about 90 degree Fahrenheit weather on the beaches of Delaware to trade that in for temperatures at about minus 18 degrees Fahrenheit in Antarctica. We had days where the wind chill made it about minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit, which was quite chilly, but it was certainly an adventure. And then if you go to the next slide, while Mike was here, he collected data every day, both air temperature in degrees Fahrenheit and the wind chill. So as you can see, September seems to be the coldest month, though August was also very, very chilly. But we're getting down to temperatures. One day we had a minus 80 degree wind chill day, which was definitely the worst, but it was always pretty much below freezing. There were a few days where we kind of had a temperature spike, but most of the time it was pretty chilly. So then if you go to the next slide, you'll see what we saw when we got here. So this is McMurdo. It's essentially a small town. We have about 1,200 people here. And if you look, I've labeled the important places, at least for me. So I frequented the dorms, which is where I slept. We have the cafeteria, and then we have the laboratory. And then we have the sea ice, which is where I do most of my research. But there are so many buildings on station. I think there are over 200 buildings, but this is all just science support. So definitely being a scientist, even though McMurdo is definitely a science-based place, there are so many different people that are required to maintain the station because it is a small town, and we do have a lot of requirements to survive in Antarctica. So we have things like a carpenter shop, an electrical shop, a power plant. We have water treatment plant, a mechanic shop, weather station. We have food rooms. I mean, we have just about everything on station that we would have back home in a regular functioning town. So even though there are very few scientists, we have so many people that are just supporting our work here that really we couldn't survive without. If you wanna, yeah.
Yeah, there was a question about what time of year that picture was taken.
This was taken about when we got there. So when we got there, there were 4 hours of daylight and the rest was complete darkness. So when we first got there, this is what we saw. When it was light, it wasn't really a bright, bright light. It was kind of like dusk for 4 hours a day. But then every day you have an extra 30 minutes of daylight. And once September hit, we started to get actual sunlight as opposed to just this, like, hazy dusk.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Then if you want to go to the next slide. So science in Antarctica, like I said, this is essentially the main focus of the station. And it happens in a lot of different forms. So there really is something for every teacher, for every classroom. There's just so many different projects going on that you can really get a taste of anything that you're interested in Antarctica. So you have people working out at the field and field camps. You have right next to McMurdo or the Dry Valleys, and there's a lot of research going on out there. They have little camps set up. You have research going on in the lab, which is primarily where I'm based out of. So we have a big building called Crary. It's got, I'd say, about 30 laboratory spaces that people share, and it's, you know, a big hub of science in Antarctica for sure. And then you also have, particularly of interest to my project, a lot of research going on under the sea ice. So our project, at the beginning at least, during collection, was dive centered. So every day we'd go out, drill some holes in the sea ice, which I'll talk about in a little while, and send one of our divers down to collect some samples. But there really is a lot of different science going on throughout Antarctica. Particularly, we have the areas of geology and geography that are pretty big. We have astronomy and meteorology. We have a lot of climate studies, and we also have a lot of science, including like biology, ecology, and that sort of thing. So if you want to go to the next slide, I'll start talking about a couple of the bigger projects on station. Wait, can you guys still hear me?
Yeah, we do. That was kind of weird tones. I'm not sure what that is, but we'll keep going.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm not sure either. Okay.
Thanks for
So in terms of geology and geography, some of my friends are on a project called IceCap. It's based out of Texas, and they're coming down here basically to map out East Antarctica. So they're just looking for different features in the sea ice, and they're basically just creating a map of the area. So I don't know if you guys know too much about Google Maps, but right now there's a pretty big push to be able to actually zoom in on different parts of the continent of Antarctica. So that's currently underway and kind of an exciting project. And then in the picture in the middle top, you have an archaeologist looking for fossils in Antarctica. That's a very, very important part of climate study and stuff like that, just looking at what the continent was like millions of years ago. And I don't know if any of you know, but this used to be a tropical rainforest, so some of the fossils that they're finding are pretty incredible. And underneath that, on the large photo, you have two scientists looking at meteorite fragments. That's a pretty big area of interest, especially in Antarctica. And then on the right, one of the biggest, I'd say, areas of scientific interest is ice coring. Not so much in McMurdo, but in different places like Waste Divide, we have the Vostok ice sheet, which is Russia's area. But a lot of American scientists get the privilege to go there. But essentially, we have very, very wide array of mechanisms of drilling into the ice and collecting ice cores, like what you'll see at the bottom right-hand corner. And in looking at those ice cores, you can see what the carbon dioxide quantity in the atmosphere was like at different periods. It's very stratified, so you can tell which sections of the ice formed at which time. And you can also see different bacteria that were inhabiting the area and all kinds of things like that that a lot of people are very interested in studying. And if you go to the next slide, we have a lot of astronomy and meteorology. There's a facility in McMurdo called LDB, the Long Duration Balloon Building. And this building essentially produces what we see on the top left. This is a picture of Blast Pole, which is basically just a telescope attached to a gigantic balloon that will be launched into the atmosphere, will fly for about 30 days. And this project in particular was monitoring galaxy formation, which you can see at the large picture at the bottom. That's a map that they made from their project 2 years ago. So this is a pretty exciting project that is very much ongoing. And then at the top right, we have IceCube, which is a very important telescope that's located at the South Pole Station, which is at the geographical south pole of the world. So that's at another station, but it is a very large project, and I'd say pretty much the dominant project going on at South Pole Station. And then if you go to the next slide, one of the very exciting things, especially in the past couple of weeks, is the climate change research going on in Antarctica. So like I talked about before, we have a lot of ice coring projects, which you can see a demonstration of, you know, the coring removal at the top left. But also, we have the graph produced at the bottom left. This is just a graph produced by looking at and analyzing the different ice cores that were collected. As I said before, we can look and glean temperature information and carbon dioxide concentration by looking at these cores. We also have, if you look at the top right, we have a lot of different survey flights going out to look at glaciers and looking at how different ice sheets are reacting to environmental changes. So So a lot of survey flights, including ICECAP, are just looking at, you know, how is an ice sheet changing over time? What sorts of changes are happening? Is there melting going on? And all of the sonar and stuff on their planes is able to detect changes in depth of the ice sheet, movement of the ice sheet, et cetera. And then at the bottom right is of particular interest, especially in the last couple of weeks. I'm not sure if you guys have heard, but my mom heard from, she's from New Jersey, and she called me to tell me that, you know, the Pig Glacier is calving, which, I mean, it was a pretty big deal here, but somehow she found out about it. But essentially, the Pine Island Glacier is of particular interest because there's a huge calving event that's going on that we kind of, NASA discovered pretty much accidentally. But a large, large piece of this glacier is calving off, and this is a very large source of uncertainty in global sea level rise, different movement patterns of the glacier and stuff like that. So that's an area of particular interest right now. And if you go to the next slide, this is what I'm primarily interested in as the biology, ecology, life science side of things. So what we have going on, at least right now, in terms of the projects that I'm aware of, we have a lot of work going on in antifreeze proteins in fish. So there are a couple groups down here right now looking at that. So they'll go out, go fishing, collect some fish, and then study the antifreeze proteins. If you go to the next picture at the top in the center, we have a lot of people studying penguin colonies. And then on the right, we have a picture of a scientist studying in a deli. Then at the bottom left, I know one of the polar trek teachers coming out is coming to study the Weddell seal populations. If you look on top of this seal, they put a camera and some sensory probes. Essentially, these probes can capture video of Weddell seals catching prey. It also takes measurements of depth and temperature, which is really interesting in studying temperature changes in the water column. This is actually our best way to study how temperatures are fluctuating in terms of the actual water column itself and over time. So this is really interesting. And then at the bottom right, we have a picture of Stacy Kim's project from a couple years ago. There's a lot of work going on benthic community ecology at the bottom of the sea ice on the seafloor. So you can see large nematarian worms, a lot of starfish. And this is an ongoing project that they come back to year after year. So that's a really cool opportunity. Then if you go to the next slide, what I'm particularly interested in is temperature adaptation. And I'm looking at this both genetically and physiologically. So back home in Delaware, we study, and we're studying this in worms. So worms, why worms? They're really easy to culture. We have a pretty good idea of what their genome sequence should look like. We've sequenced one species, and throughout the genus, there's very little variation. So our lab is focused on worms in terms of looking at adaptive processes. But back home in Delaware, we collect this worm called Capitella tulita. So this is found from Delaware to Florida. It's very easy to find where we're from. And then in Antarctica, there's a member of the genus called Capitella pararmata. And if you look, they look almost identical. Their genome's basically the same, but one lives in Delaware and one lives in the McMurdo Sound, Antarctica. So what is enabling this worm to survive in freezing, below freezing temperatures? In the water, we have temperatures reaching minus 1.5 degrees Celsius, right, in the Sound. So what's enabling this worm to survive, whereas Capitella tulita, which seems almost identical, is limited to, you know, Florida and Delaware. So then if you go to the next slide, the first part of our process is collection. So that's why we needed five team members here at the beginning. We needed to get our worms. And these worms are living in the mud at the bottom of the ocean under the sea ice. So the first big project is drilling a dive hole, which we had to do about every day to get enough sampling locations. But essentially, you have this big reed drill with a four-foot auger bit. You kind of just plunge it through the sea ice. It drills a hole. You get a pretty clean hole. Then on the top right, you can see a picture. We have dive huts that we put over these holes. They're heated, and they just keep the hole clean so we don't have to re-drill them if we need to reuse the site. And if you look at the bottom right, I don't know if you guys can see it, but there's a seal sharing our dive hole. So seals need to come up for air. And a very easy way, if they don't want to make their own crack through the sea ice or find a crack, is to come hang out in an already drilled dive hole. So you get a lot of visitors for sure. So once we have our dive hole, the three divers on our team would go down, scoop some mud, put it in some buckets and bring it to the top, and me and Stephanie, my lab mate, would be responsible for sorting through it. Then if you go to the next slide, you can see a picture of Mike doing some collection. He's collecting some starfish in this picture, but I thought it was a nicer picture than him holding some buckets full of mud, so I put this one up instead. But our lab does do a little bit of work on temperature adaptation in starfish and some nematarian worms, so it's not that far-fetched. Anyway, if you go to,
there was a question that came up from Bruce. He was asking, do you have to worry about leopard seals?
Leopard seals are a big problem in the peninsula. So at Palmer Station, they're a pretty big problem. And also if we get out to the sea ice edge, so at the interface between the sea ice and open water, then we have to start worrying about Weddell seals or about leopard seals. But as far in as we are, we don't really go that far away from station, and there really are no leopard seals in this area, so we don't worry about them, but people studying a little further off have to.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. So if you want to go to – I'm not sure if you guys have changed, but this is the worm picking slide.
We're changing.
Okay. So they bring me up these large buckets of mud, and essentially I use a sieve to filter out the smaller sediment, and I literally pick worms off of the sieve. This takes hours and hours, and I've literally had dreams about picking worms because it's so monotonous. But these worms that I'm looking for, they are about a centimeter long and the width of a pencil lead. So I'm looking for really tiny pink worms in a sieve, and it was pretty bad while that was happening. But if you want to go to the next slide, you pick out all the worms you find, and then you look at them under the microscope. So I'm particularly collecting two different worms. One, like I said before, is Capitella paramata. And then kind of like a side project is another worm, which you can see at the bottom right. It's Theophanes churnii. So they're both annelids, but they're different worms. But anyway, so once I collect the worms from the mud that I'm looking at, I look at them under the microscope. I identify them. And the ones that are either Capitella or Theophanes, I pick out and I put in these trays of mud that I've collected from the seafloor filled with about an inch of water, and I keep them in an incubator at minus 1.5 Celsius, which is what they're used to in the ocean.
Oh.
And then if you go to the next slide, the basis of my experiment, like I said before, was adaptation and acclimation. So what does this mean? This essentially means that I'm looking for the mechanisms that these worms use to survive when they're stressed out, so that I can kind of get a little bit of a picture as to how they're able to survive in such an extreme environment. So looking at both of my worm species, I'm going to see what they do when they're introduced to a temperature stress, specifically heating them up. So like I said before, these worms are used to being at minus 1.5 Celsius. So I pick them out of that. I put them in their culture trays of mud and seawater, and I let them sit for 2 weeks. So let them chill out, get used to sitting in a culture tub instead of in the bottom of the ocean. Let them kind of settle out in terms of the population. But then I'm splitting them into their control and experimental groups. So the control group will stay at minus 1.5 Celsius, but the experimental group will be heated up to 4 degrees Celsius. This is a pretty big change, considering that these worms would never have experienced 4 degrees Celsius. But this temperature change is within the limits of the projected sea level temperature increase over the next couple hundred years. So we're trying to give them something that's going to stress them out but not necessarily kill them, is essentially how I'm trying to monitor their adaptation to stressful environments. So then if you go to the next slide, So I heat these worms up. What am I looking for? I'm looking for both physiological and biochemical changes associated with their response to this temperature increase. So I'm looking at physiological properties, like how does their body volume change? And the basis for this is that we know in Antarctica things are bigger. So sponges from the same genus as sponges, let's say, from the Caribbean, these sponges are huge. They're bigger than people. So there's giganticism happening in Antarctica. And I just wanted to see if maybe there was a reversal of that, if there was a heating up, or if there was any other body volume cool changes. The other thing is respiration rate. So as humans, if we're stressed out, we do tend to respire more. We have an increase in respiration rate. So are these worms also exhibiting that? So to do that, I'm just basically putting them in some wells and looking at oxygen concentration over time. The other two are a little more specific. I'm looking at citrate synthase activity. Basically, citrate synthase is an enzyme that's in the process of generating ATP. So the more citrate synthase you have, the more you're metabolically capable of doing. So that is known to change over time. And I'm also looking at mitochondrial density within cells. So the mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cell, and the amount of mitochondria in a cell can change over time. So I'm trying to see if, you know, in responding to this stress, if they're actually generating more energy and generating more powerhouses to produce more energy. So on the other side of things, perhaps I think most interestingly, are the biochemical changes. So by that I mean the genetic changes associated with acclimation and adaptation. And specifically I'm looking at methylation, and I'll talk about that in the next slide if you want to change over. So I'm particularly looking at a field called epigenetics. So you have your regular genome, let's say. You have your DNA. It's a double helix, two strands made of nucleotide bases. That's in the double helix shape. But in order to get that to fit into your chromosome, that DNA is wound around these histone proteins, and it's kind of like a spool of yarn. So some areas, and it's a messy spool that's always changing. Some areas are tight, some areas are loose. And what's interesting about that is you have something that reads your DNA, and that's what makes proteins, which, you know, is what generates your phenotype, essentially. So areas that are really tightly wound, they're blocking, physically blocking that reader from coming through to read that gene. So if there's an area that's really tightly wrapped, that transcription factor that reads it isn't able to function. It's not able to read that gene, so that gene is turned off. And the interesting part about this is the tightness of different areas changes over time, and we know that that's in response to environmental variability. So as you experience new environments, as you start to adapt to new environments, the way your DNA is wrapped around these proteins changes, so that either turns on genes by loosening areas up, or it turns off genes by tightening them. And we also have another phenomenon very similar to that, where you have different chemical groups that can attach to your DNA. So things like a methyl group, which is what I'm particularly interested in, can bind to your DNA. And this is basically just like a roadblock. So that thing that reads your DNA is going to be stopped when it reaches this methyl group, let's say, and that's going to essentially serve to turn off the gene. And similar to what I was saying before, these methyl groups can be added or subtracted from the DNA throughout an organism's lifetime. And this is how we're responding as individuals to our environment. So this isn't over generations, though it can be passed from parent to offspring. This is a very short-scale, immediate, let's say, reaction to your environment. So this is what I'm looking for. So adaptation is not just about what's in your genes, it's about what's on your genes, so how they're wrapped, what chemical groups are added to it. So in order to do this, I've developed a variety of sequencing mechanisms and way to look at the sequencing results through bioinformatics to see how, specifically, how methyl groups are being added or subtracted from genomes over time in response to a stress, in this case, temperature stress. So if you want to go to the next slide, this is pretty cool. So I'm looking at worms now, but this isn't necessarily what I want to do forever. I'm really interested in looking at cancer epigenetics in the future. But what's really cool about what we're doing here in Antarctica is that we're developing this tool set for sequencing genomes, for looking at these results to see how the epigenome is responding to stress. But the tools for looking at this, you know, are the same as tools for looking at anybody else's DNA. So looking at a human cell line, looking at a rat cell line, it's all the same. We have the techniques, and it's very much a global relevance. And what's really interesting is our advisor back in Delaware is starting to look at the epigenetic effects of early onset Parkinson's disease and looking at ways to combat that in addition to Lyme disease infection. So this really does have a broader societal impact, a little larger than Antarctic worms, but still pretty cool. And then if you want to go to the next slide, I think what was most exciting for me, especially having Mike on the team, I was just remembering that, you know, our work here is pretty cool, but big deal if, you know, a couple scientists know how, you know, epigenetic changes are happening with temperature adaptation. I think the really exciting part of this project was being able to share different parts of our experiences with classrooms throughout the world. So Mike wrote over 70 journals, and we had a lot of participation with that. We also had a lot of online sessions, mostly Skype, with individual classrooms, but it was really exciting because I think what a lot of scientists don't really remember is the scientific method is the same no matter what, no matter if you are doing your first science project in your kitchen, you know, at home when you're five, or whether you're, you know, an advanced cell biologist. It's all the same, and it's really cool just being able to inspire a lot of different students, a lot of different classrooms, just to explore their environment, you know. I mean, every project has a broader impact, and just inspiring a lot of young students to get, you know, interested in the field and just excited about science and excited about, you know, Antarctica, and, you know, just cultivating a new group of scientific explorers has just been super, super exciting, especially for me. And I know that I'm really excited to continue this throughout my stay in Antarctica. And then even when I get home back in Delaware, we've come up with a lot of collaboration projects, and I know Mike's pretty excited about continuing this through his teaching career. So that's about it for me. If you guys have any questions or anything, I'd be more than happy to answer it. I'm just so excited about my work, and I'm so grateful that you guys took the time to listen to it. But, yeah, that's it for me.
Great job, Anna Marie. Very interesting. There was a comment that came up from Mary, and I think she's right. She said that Michael, you know, even with all of his journals, he never really touched on, you know, your particular parts and just the, you know, the depth, and it was just really interesting. So,
I'm glad.
Yeah, so, and we can tell you to love your work, which is also another bonus.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. That was so interesting.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for asking me to do this.
Yeah, so if you guys have, if the participants have questions, you can click on that little hand icon below your name, and that lets me, we can go live, and then you can ask your questions directly to Anna Marie. In the meantime, I see Bruce does have a question. He says, where can we learn more about epigenetics?
Epigenetics is a pretty big field right now. Honestly, where I started out was just Wikipedia. So when I went to undergrad, I had no background in genetics, let alone epigenetics. And the Internet really is a really good source just for basic information. So epigenetics is a growing field, but to be honest, we know very little about it. So it's, you know, it's quite a big adventure for sure, but Mike talks about it a little bit, I think, in some of his journals, but I don't know if that's necessarily the best research for the science end of things, but I'd be more than willing to talk to anybody about my work. I'm so excited about it. But, yeah, the Internet's a great resource.
Okay, yep, and we'll share their email address with you so they can talk directly to you.
That's great.
So So we do have a question from Elizabeth, or Liz. Go ahead and hold down the talk button the entire time you're talking, and then let go. Free. Elizabeth? Okay, we can't hear from her. So we'll go to Allison. Go ahead, Allison.
Well, first of all, thank you. Your enthusiasm is contagious, and to be that enthusiastic about worms is pretty exciting. I was curious to know how the collection process and study compares to what you did in Delaware previous to traveling down there.
Well, I don't know if it's lucky or unlucky, but I just started a year and a half ago, so our cultures of Capitella Toledo were already in place when I got to Delaware, so I didn't actually get the opportunity to do any collection, but I imagine it would be the same sort of idea, just instead of drilling through the ice, just going out on a beach dive, essentially, so you don't have to go that far down in the ocean. These worms are at about 50 feet, so just doing a couple dives off of Delaware should have been roughly the same, just collecting a lot of mud from the, or sand, I guess in this case, from the bottom of the ocean, sieving it out for worms. But it should be almost identical, just a little warmer.
Okay. Elizabeth, do you want to try again? Hold down the talk button the entire time you're talking. It's right above the chat. Block. All right, nothing. So we'll go to Bruce.
Thanks. That was really interesting, Anne-Marie. Thanks for showing us that. Just a couple questions I had was, what kind of lab setup do you have down there to do this kind of work and the genetics work that you're doing? And how did you decide to work on worms, and are there other organisms you could use to do the same kind of research?
Our lab setup here is pretty good. I have the ability to do a lot of, like, metabolic studies, so I'm doing respiration rates here. I'm doing citrate synthase activity rates here. But that's pretty much where it ends in Antarctica. We don't have, let's say, genome sequencing technology or anything like that for the bigger aspects of our project. So I basically just ship samples home. I extract DNA from these worms here, ship them home in like an ethanol base, and then I do all my sequencing work back home. So it's a little bit limited, but considering we are in Antarctica, I'm pretty impressed by what we got in terms of capability to do science here. But you're right, most of it can't really happen here. And in terms of our study organism, there for sure are many, many different organisms that we could use to study temperature adaptation, from human cell lines to starfish to fish, really anything. The idea behind using this worm in particular was that we'd been working with a worm from the same genus that was almost identical back in Delaware. So that was the basis of our choice to study a worm this year for this specific project, and also just the ease of culturing. So my advisor's been to Antarctica, I think, 15 times, and he's worked with a variety of organisms, a lot of larval fish, starfish, larger invertebrates. But they're a lot harder to cultivate in a culture just because they don't reproduce that quickly. You know, they're harder to keep alive. You have to feed them a lot. Whereas these worms, you kind of give them some food and they just reproduce and they can really start up a culture in a relatively quick period of time, whereas another organism would be a little more challenging to work with under a time frame deadline.
All right, thank you. Anybody else have questions that they want to ask?
I did. This is Story. I just logged in a few minutes ago.
Okay, go ahead.
I loved what I saw of your presentation, and what I was interested in was how, what kind of things did you do to integrate what you had studied with the worms into your class, into the classrooms of other teachers?
I think probably the most exciting thing is we take a lot of videos of transects. I mean, I don't because I'm not a diver, but when they go under the ice diving, they take a lot of videos of transect lines. So what we're doing now is we're trying to send those things off to teachers with, let's say, an index of different species that you'd find in Antarctica and asking different classrooms to do analysis, essentially, of these video transects. And this is going to go into a larger project of ecology of the seafloor in Antarctica. So I think that's one of the coolest things that's going on. But so far in Antarctica, what we've really been doing is just talking a lot about we've done a lot of work on climates, different biome work with classrooms focused on biome studies in their science classes. We can kind of tailor our work to a lot of different areas, even just as basic as talking about the scientific method and what it means to go through different steps to be a good scientist, what it means to collect data, what it means to, you know, record observations. Just the most basic things. Our work, you know, it seems pretty complex, but it's really not. All science really goes down to the simple principle of, you know, discovery and observation and following a protocol, essentially.
Okay. Thanks for that. Megan has a question. Go ahead, Megan. Maybe.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you, and I can see how I can apply this to all of my classes. And I was wondering, even the you said you're studying worms from Delaware and Florida, and would that type of would they have different temperature adaptation? Just because I would think the water would get a lot cooler in Florida. I mean, excuse me, in Delaware, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what's so exciting. So our worms back home, we're actually cooling them down. And they absolutely are very much accustomed to a much larger change in temperature than these worms. Because the cool thing about this is since they're in seawater, it's pretty much a temperature buffer for these guys. So they're really not experiencing too much of a fluctuation. The fluctuation that they see in the environment is about 0.3 degrees, whereas you're right, up in Delaware, there would be a much larger change. But these guys are under, you know, a frozen ice sheet. They've got the salt water to buffer them. They've really, you know, there isn't too much mixing up here since there is an ice sheet over top of the water. So these guys are definitely not used to a temperature change like the worms in Delaware. So there are limitations in that, but it is very interesting to consider.
Okay.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Questions? All right. Well, I posted the wiki address online, and we're trying to encourage the wiki site to be used by both the researchers and teachers, not just within this class, but also just teachers that are interested in polar sciences. So we'll make sure you get that, Anna Marie, as well, if we have.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Because it's kind of outside the course system, so it's not a closed discussion, it's open. That's the only way we
okay.
Can do that. Yeah, so I don't know. We'll
can I ask?
Oh, yes, go ahead, Bruce.
Can I ask? Anne-Marie, I saw that you went to Vassar College.
Yeah.
When did you graduate?
I graduated in 2010, so this is about a year and a half out for me.
I went there also, and my daughter goes there right now.
Oh, no way. Oh, wow. Yeah, I loved it. It was a really – it wasn't a really big science school, but the science teachers there for sure inspired me incredibly. So I could not have been any happier with my experience.
Yeah, I was a geology major there, and it's great to see science people coming out of that school.
Yeah, for sure. There aren't too many of us still, but the people who do come out are doing some pretty incredible things.
and for everybody for joining. And we will put this archive both on our website and in the course, and then and we'll just make sure that you guys all can connect with one another through the wiki and through emails and keep up the discussions. And we just wanted to let everybody that's on know that we have another presentation that's related to this, but it's the Arctic on Monday the 14th, and that's with Sarah Hardy from UAF. So, again, thank you, Anna Marie. It was a great presentation, and nice to hear your voice again. All right. That's it from our end, and we'll just stay on here, and if you guys want to say thank you, you're welcome to do so, and otherwise we'll talk to you all again on Monday.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Thank you guys so much for listening.
Thank you also. I also had a question regarding how do you get the hand on the screen? I'm not finding a place where I can do chat or raise the hand, because I didn't want to interrupt anybody.
Oh, Story, you don't see the little chat feature, or you must be missing something or it didn't install everything for you. Because at the bottom portion of the whole whole screen, there's like a little white text area. Do you see the chat going on at all?
No, I don't see any chat happening. I've got a talk button, a microphone, a person, a video camera, and a telephone with a menu for options, but nothing else is on.
Nothing below. It's something happened when you logged in. So there's a whole bunch of things. There's just a whole other set of things that is below that bar that you see. Including the list of participants, and that's where that little hand icon is, and then the ARCUS logo is in the bottom right. So we can stay here for a little bit if you want to test out your system. I recommend you go click on the lobby. Do you see that lobby button or the words that says lobby?
Yes, I do.
Okay, click on lobby, go out, and come back in and see if it works.
And thanks to everybody else.
Yep.
Have a good day.
Thank you.